Welcome to the award-winning Beverage Chronicles, the show where beer, wine, spirits, and everything in between get the spotlight. You'll hear the stories, meet the people, and discover the pours behind your favorite drinks. Here's your host, Gary Monteroso.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to Beverage Chronicles. Gary Monteroso here. We've got a busy show, a lot going on today. You'll be hearing from some of our regulars as usual. And I'm going to lead off with a report on some beers that are making a comeback. Have you ever noticed that some beers just seem to disappear? One day they're everywhere, and the next they're gone. But here's the interesting part. More and more of those lost beers are making a comeback. Take California's 21st Amendment Brewery. It started as a small San Francisco brew pub in 2000 and grew into one of America's largest craft breweries. Its Hell or High Watermelon Wheat became a huge success. But like many breweries, it ran into trouble during the pandemic. Between supply chain issues, can shortages, and slowing sales, the brewery eventually shut its doors. That could have been the end of the story. Instead, a Philadelphia brewery called Evil Genius purchased the recipes and brand names and has brought many of those beers back to market. Same recipes, same artwork, same familiar flavors, and they're not alone. Across the country, breweries are discovering that nostalgia can be surprisingly powerful. Consumers often remember that one beer they loved years ago and wonder whatever happened to it. Breweries are beginning to answer that question. New Belgium recently celebrated its anniversary by bringing back original versions of several classic beers, including the original Fat Tire Amber Ale. Bell's Brewery has released throwback variety packs featuring beers longtime fans thought they'd never see again. For breweries, these just aren't sentimental projects. They're smart business. When today's beer market is crowded and consumers have more choices than ever, bringing back a familiar favorite can reconnect former customers with the brand. Lagunitas Brewing has found success by periodically reviving beers like Hop Stupid and Sugar. These limited releases remind drinkers why they fell in love with the brewery in the first place. There's another interesting trend happening too. Some breweries are partnering with homebrew companies, allowing fans to brew retired beers right in their own kitchens. Imagine recreating a beer you haven't been able to buy in years. For beer enthusiasts, that's a pretty exciting opportunity. Regional beer brands are also enjoying a second life. In Iowa, Confluence Brewing revived Old Tavern Beer, a local favorite dating back to 1908. In New Orleans, Port Orleans Brewing resurrected Jack's, a classic local lager that hadn't been brewed for decades. Even the bottle was designed to resemble the original. Then there's Narragansett, one of America's greatest comeback stories. Originally founded in 1890, the brand disappeared before being revived in the mid-2000s. Today, it's thriving by embracing its history while introducing the beer to an entirely new generation of drinkers. Of course, not every comeback works. Several years ago, Pabst attempted to revive Ballantine IPA. It was historically accurate, but consumer tastes had changed. Beer drinkers had moved toward juicy New England-style IPAs, while Ballantine's older, resinous recipe simply didn't connect with modern audiences. That's the challenge with nostalgia. People often say they want an old favorite back, but saying it and actually buying it are two very different things. Successful revivals aren't really about living in the past. They're about honoring a brewery's history while giving today's drinkers something meaningful to discover. Because eventually, today's favorite beers will become tomorrow's classics. And maybe 20 years from now, someone will be asking, "Hey, remember that beer? I wish they'd bring it back." Fortunately, more breweries are making sure that wish might just come true. Now here's a wine report with Robin Shreves.
I recently saw a headline that read, "Is chilled red wine the new rosé?" It seems everyone is drinking their reds with a little chill on them lately, but should all reds be served colder? Let's talk about it. You may follow the conventional guidance that says to serve red wine at room temperature, but what is that? When it comes to wine, room temperature should really be cellar temperature, generally considered somewhere between 55 and 59 degrees. Many people keep their wine in their dining room or kitchen, where temperatures are usually somewhere in the 70s, and serving red wines that warm can dull some of their aromas and flavors. So basically many of us, me included, because wine doesn't always make it down to my cellar before I pop its cork, drink reds a little warmer than at their optimal temperatures. But when we're talking specifically about chilled reds, ones that are particularly lovely to drink in summer's heat, the temperature of some reds can go even lower. Light-bodied, fresh and fruity reds with low tannins like Pinot Noir, Gamay, or even a Cabernet Franc that hasn't seen much oak do well with a bit more chill than cellar temperature. You can take them down to 50 degrees if you'd like, and it will bring out more of their fruitiness. For some specific bottle recommendations, I turned to a few friends. David Gardner, winemaker at New Jersey's Bellevue Winery, recommends Chamberson, a wine Bellevue and many of the region's other wineries produce. Chamberson is known for its soft tannins and its high acidity, and Gardner says that chilling a bottle keeps it refreshing while not accentuating any bitterness. Sandy Friedman, a wine professional and educator from Philadelphia, recommends Do Nothing Red Blend, a solidly delicious light red from Oregon's Fossil and Fawn. It's a great candidate for chilling and a perfect pairing with hot dogs. She also recommends Barbachette's Ouinon, a co-ferment of six different grapes. Friedman says the Brooklyn-produced wine reminds her of a summertime Beaujolais Nouveau, that French wine that most people think of first when they think of chilled reds. And that lightly or non-oaked Cabernet Franc mentioned earlier, wine writer Kathleen Wilcox loves throwing a fresh and bright, cool climate Finger Lakes Cabernet Franc in the fridge for about 20 minutes before serving it with cheddar cheese, hot dogs, or a hearty salad. Which brings us to how to add that chill to the bottle. Popping it in the fridge for 20 to 30 minutes will do the trick. So will wrapping the bottle in a wet paper or kitchen towel and putting it in the freezer for 15 minutes. Another way to cool down a bottle is to put it in a water and ice bath. Use a wine bucket, a large mixing bowl, a big pitcher, or anything else that will fit your bottle. You don't have to get fancy with it to make your red wine extra refreshing. I'm Robin Shreves, and you can find more of my wine commentary and thoughts in my Drink Local Substack newsletter.
What is up, everybody? Rachel here, aka Brews with Beerkowski, and I am here to talk to you today about some beer history. I'm a certified Cicerone, and I am a historian, and today we're going to be talking about how homebrewers built American craft beer. So, let's get nerdy. Before craft beer was an industry, it was a hobby. Before tap rooms, hazy IPAs, and brewery lines that span around the block, there were people brewing in their kitchens, garages, and backyards. And without them, the American craft beer movement simply wouldn't exist. Let's rewind to the mid-20th century. After Prohibition ended in 1933, American beer became dominated by a handful of large breweries. These companies focused on consistency, scale, and broad appeal. The results? A light, clean, easy-drinking lager, but not of much diversity. For decades, that was the American beer landscape. But something was bubbling under the surface. People started brewing at home. Technically, home brewing had never fully disappeared. Even during Prohibition, people found ways to make beer quietly, often using malt extract sold as a baking ingredient. But it wasn't until 1978 when homebrewing was officially legalized in the United States under President Jimmy Carter. And that's when things really took off. Suddenly, anyone could brew legally in their own home. And they certainly did. Early homebrewers weren't just recreating beers that they could buy. They were trying to recreate beers they couldn't find, like European ales, British bitters, German lagers, Belgian saisons, styles that had all but disappeared from American grocery store shelves. They experimented, they failed, they refined. They shared recipes and built a community rooted in curiosity and creativity. And then some of them went pro. Names that now define American craft beer all started as homebrewers. people like Ken Grossman, who built his own equipment before launching Sierra Nevada, Jim Koch, who revived a family recipe to create Sam Adams. Even pioneers like Fritz Maytag helped spark a movement that homebrewers would carry forward. Homebrewing created a culture where experimentation wasn't just allowed, it was expected. That mindset became the foundation of craft beer. Instead of brewing beer for mass appeal, craft brewers brewed for flavor. Instead of sticking to one style, they explored hundreds. Instead of consistency above all else, they embraced creativity. Techniques like dry hopping, barrel aging, and mixed fermentation were many of the ideas that were refined and popularized by homebrewers before they ever even hit the commercial scale. Even today, that spirit is still alive. Homebrewers are still pushing boundaries, still testing new ingredients, still driving innovation from the ground up. Many breweries still recruit talent directly from the homebrewing community. So the next time you walk into a craft brewery and look at the tap list and see something wild, creative, unexpected, remember where it came from. It didn't start in a boardroom. It didn't start in a factory. It started in someone's kitchen with a pot, a passion, and a willingness to experiment. Homebrewing didn't just influence craft beer. It built it.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Beverage Chronicles, your source for the stories shaping the global beverage industry. I'm Michelle Lamb, co-host of Beverage Chronicles. In each episode, we take you behind the labels to meet the people, the brands, and innovators shaping today's beverage world. From fine wine, craft beer, and premium spirits, to coffee, tea, non-alcoholic beverages, and emerging drinks categories. Today, we're exploring an important topic, why public relations matters for storytelling in the AI era. Let's get started. Public relations builds trust and credibility. In today's digital world, consumers are exposed to an overwhelming amount of AI-generated content. As information becomes easier to create, credibility becomes harder to earn. Public relations helps organizations build trust through earned media, expert interviews, thought leadership, awards, and authentic relationships with journalists and industry leaders. Key takeaway, trust isn't bought through advertising. It's earned through credibility. Thank you for joining us on Beverage Chronicles. If you enjoyed today's episode, be sure to share. I'm Michelle Lamb, co-host of Beverage Chronicles. Until next time, remember, every beverage has a story, and every story has the power to inform, inspire, and connect. Cheers, and thanks for listening.
So we heard from our regular contributors, Robin Shreves with her wine report, Rachel Benkowski, our beer historian, and finally, my co-host, Michelle Lamb. I'm going to close by talking about one of my favorite beverages, 12 months out of the year. It's a non-alcoholic drink, and it's seltzer. If you're thinking of reaching for a can of it, and you're under the impression that it's always the healthiest choice, well, it's certainly better than sugary soda. But there are a few things worth knowing. Not all bubbly water is the same. There are natural mineral waters like Perrier and San Pellegrino, which obviously contain naturally occurring minerals. But then there's club soda, and that often has added sodium for flavor. Now, if you're watching your salt intake, it may be a good idea to check the label. Also, too much carbonation can aggravate acid reflux or other digestive issues. And because carbonated water is slightly acidic, frequent sipping can contribute to tooth enamel wear over time. Now, there's good news. Plain seltzer remains one of the healthiest fizzy drinks you can enjoy. Most experts agree that having one a day is perfectly reasonable as part of a balanced diet. So, enjoy the bubbles. But remember, when it comes to any beverage, moderation is still the best ingredient. And that is a wrap for this week's episode of Beverage Chronicles. Gary Monteroso here. And as a reminder, you can check us out on Facebook, Instagram, and LinkedIn, and also our website, which is in the process of being redesigned, is beveragechronicles.com. There's a place there where you can contact us if you have some feedback, program suggestions, just want to tell us whether you like us or don't like something we did. We're fine with that. We just love to hear from you, and we appreciate your being with us every week. Okay, that's it, everyone. Take care. Bye-bye.